Hi. This episode would tell the story of the Red Lady of Paviland, a skeleton found in South Wales and dating back 33,000 years ago to a period called the Upper Paleolithic. This was a time rich in woolly mammoths and hairy, burly men wearing furs and living in caves. Today we're going to ask, who is the Red Lady? What was life like during the European Stone Age? And how did the Red Lady skeleton end up in a Welsh cave? During this discussion, we're going to talk about gender roles, the nature of hunter-gatherer societies, and the role religion plays in creating a community. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. As we wander back towards the last ice age, let's just pause for a moment in 1823. In this year, William Buckland, a professor of geology at the University of Oxford, published his book entitled Evidence of the Flood. In this book, he attempted to present a series of evidence for the Genesis flood. You know the one, with a big ark and all the animals entering two by two. Stick with me. This immediate diversion is well worth the effort. You're going to be tempted to discount Professor Buckland as a crackpot loon. And you'd be right. He often lectured from horseback and insisted on conducting his fieldwork in an academic gown, a fancier version of the things you wear to graduate from university. Not only that, but despite being a lover of animals, he was also hell-bent on eating them all. On his menu, there were the usual exotic items, crocodile, mouse, etc. But he also reportedly devoured bluebottle flies, moles, and allegedly, the preserved heart of Louis XIV of France. But he was also a muddy-fingered genius. He won multiple awards and was the first reader of geology at the Royal Society. He's most famous for describing the first dinosaur, making him a father of paleontology. He also coined the term coprolites, or fossilized poos, and pioneered the recreating of ancient worlds by looking at the plants and animals found in the excrement of long-dead animals. He loved coprolites so much that his house featured a table inlaid with the coprolites of ancient crocodiles. Before he played a founding role in the fields of geology and paleontology, he also found time to contribute to the founding of modern archaeology. Just before Christmas in 1823, a reverend and his friend were exploring the coastal caves of South Wales. In one of those caves, they discovered the tusk of a mammoth, and after informing the landowners, more bones were discovered and described as the bones of elephants. William Buckland, who I imagine at the time was lecturing from horseback, immediately left Oxford for Wales. He spent a week there, particularly focused on a cave called Goat's Hole. This wasn't anything new for Willie Buckland. The year before, 1822, he'd published the results of an exploration of Kirkdale Cave in Yorkshire. During his time in North Yorkshire, he'd pioneered the use of careful excavation and the study of layers of sediments to establish timelines. Look, I've tried. There's no way to make that sound interesting. However, it is vital because the study of sedimentary layers is called stratigraphy. That principle, stratigraphy, is probably the single most important principle in archaeology. Mad Buckland may have been, but he was brilliant. Those archaeological techniques honed in Yorkshire meant that during his time in Goat's Hole, he discovered a fragmented skeleton surrounded by a few flints. This is the Red Lady of Paviland. Considering its age, the skeleton itself is in good shape. There's a few ribs, which rather remain, and most of the large bones on the body's left-hand side also survive. Later on in the early 20th century, another geologist called William Solas, revisited the site and led a more complete excavation. This and future digs have revealed thousands of flint objects spanning a period of more than 20,000 years. But back in 1823, our beloved nutty professor, William Buckland, was thinking long and hard about what he had found. When he published his results, he described the skeleton as the Red Lady of Paviland, and supposed her to be a prostitute or witch from the Romano-British period. That is a period around 2,000 years ago, and 31,000 years younger than the Red Lady really is. Why did Buckland get this so wrong? He was a genius by who all accounts was a true scientist, a man who was willing to change his mind in the face of new evidence. He recognised that the bones of mammoths and woolly rhinos he discovered were extremely old. However, he decided that despite those old bones sharing the same soil strata as the human skeleton, an area of understanding he invented, despite all of that, he decided that the animal bones were in fact victims of Noah's flood. Thus, whilst he was right to identify the animal bones as ancient, he misstated the human skeleton by 31,000 years. But let's cut the man some slack. First of all, he discovered and recovered this skeleton in a week. A week during a Welsh January. He excavated merely on the rumour of mammoth bones with little pre-dig preparation. When you look at the context of Buckland's career, especially the Kirkdale excavations, it's clear that his initial interest was the animal bones and the discovery of the human was a complete surprise. But what a surprise. The fossilised skeleton is still incredible today. It was the first human fossil to ever be discovered. Ever. It's still the oldest Homo sapien fossil to ever be discovered in Britain, and in Western Europe, the Red Lady of Paviland is the oldest ceremonial burial. As we've also discussed, Buckland was a committed creationist and refused to entertain the possibility that humans could have existed in Europe before Noah's flood. That is why he was willing to drop his own understanding of stratigraphy to put the mammoth and rhino bones much earlier than the human. Finally, as we tell more of these stories of discovery, stories that happened before the 1950s, there's going to be one major thing lacking that is a vital element of any modern archaeological discovery: radiocarbon dating. Today is not the day to go into dating technologies. However, they have advanced and are advancing at an incredible pace. I feel very confident telling you that the Red Lady of Paviland is 33,000 years old. However, that date is the result of a study completed only 10 years ago, 180 years after the skeleton was discovered. If there's one thing archaeologists will happily get themselves in knots about for hours and hours, it's the complexities of dating finds. It's vital, and it isn't simple. So I think we're going to leave Buckland for now, and remember him fondly as an eccentric giant of archaeology. Where was this skeleton found? The obvious answer is Paviland. We are talking about the Red Lady of Paviland. But we've been throwing that word Paviland around as though it was common knowledge. By now, I'm sure you've gathered that Paviland is a cave. It's part of a chain of caves on the very edge of the Gower Peninsula, which is a large finger of land poking into the Bristol Channel to the southwest of Swansea, in, of course, Wales. The cave itself is exposed to the brutal Celtic seas. If one was to jump from Paviland and somehow swim in a straight line surviving hypothermia and exposure, then the next land you would reach might be the Azores. Otherwise, you're paddling all the way to Puerto Rico. However, on a fine day when the seas are calm, it's a beautiful sight. The entrance to the cave is about 10 metres above the low water mark and usually remains exposed even at high tide. That's probably an important factor in preserving the skeleton. Buckland himself probably entered at low tide. Even today, the low tide access is the one almost everyone follows. The main entrance to the cave of Paviland is called Goat's Hole, and it's easily accessible for a couple of hours each day. But even then, access usually requires a bit of scrambling and splashing through small ocean inlets. The Goat's Hole entrance is large, but the cave isn't very deep. During the day, you can see all the way to the back without need for a torch. But there are mysteries to this cave. There is another entrance that comes through the roof of the cave, and there, tight, unexplored channels winding to who knows where. The beauty of today's Paviland is in its isolation. To be able to stand in a cave, sheltered from the rain, and look out at an endless stormy sea is a compelling experience. But it wasn't the experience of the Red Lady of Paviland. When the Red Lady was buried 33,000 years ago, the world was staggering through a glacial period. Huge rivers of ice grew and faded. At the largest extent, these glaciers, 3 to 4 kilometres thick, covered all but the very south coast of Britain. So things are a little bit better than the worst periods that we discussed last episode. But not by much. The rest of Western Europe was tundra. When the world warmed slightly and the glaciers retreated towards Scotland, Britain became tundra too. This is the classic image of the Ice Age. A nearly treeless, frigid grassland inhabited by megafauna. Giant animals like woolly mammoths, woolly rhinos, vast herds of reindeer, cave bears, cave lions, and colossal 7-foot-tall cows called aurochs. It was a dangerous time to be a feeble-bodied human. During the Ice Age, so much ice was locked up in the glaciers that sea levels were very low. Sometimes up to 120 meters lower than they are today. That meant the relatively shallow oceans of the North Sea and English Channel didn't exist. Instead, there were dry land, more tundra, which predators and prey alike could cross without impediment. In the Upper Paleolithic, there were no oceans near today's Gower Peninsula. In fact, the ocean was 70 kilometers away, which is about as inland as the modern-day city of York. Instead, Paviland looked out over the flat plain which is now covered by the Bristol Channel. It was the quintessential Paleolithic cave site. A raised cave sitting above ideal hunting grounds. It was in these places, these caves, that we found humans seeking refuge. As we dive deeper into the discoveries at Paviland and discuss the society and material culture of Upper Paleolithic Europe, keep in mind this phenomenon. These are rarely the sites we see today. Especially with Paviland, it's not the site you see on Google Images. Think of a hole in a cliff. One you would scramble towards, dragging any of your kills with you. Maybe at the entrance, you and your friends would light a fire and begin to cook your food as the sun sets. From the entrance, you'd have a good view of wandering herds of woolly animals. Your fire would offer some protection from the lions and bears that also made their dens in caves. In the morning, the last of you to keep watch would survey the same vista. The elevated position would give you the best chance of spotting opportunities and potential dangers. Around the last of the embers, your group could plan the day's activities, knowing that, in the worst case, this shallow cave was a shelter to retreat to. Indeed, if one of you had been wounded or slain, perhaps by another Homo sapien or perhaps by one of your prey, the cave offered somewhere safe to lay them to rest. Buckland left a lot of material at the site of Paviland. This was typical of the archaeological approach at the time, and it's one of the divisions between the gentleman antiquarians of the 18th and 19th century and the ever more rigorous professional archaeologists of the 20th and 21st century. The antiquarian approach of men like Buckland was to hear about a site, get there before anyone else could, and then dig around until you found something interesting. You then stole that away to your home museum, and for extra marks, you make some outlandish claim along with your finds and charge people to come see it. William Buckland was never one to leave extra marks on the table. Nor was he one to ever avoid being outlandish. In his week at Paviland, he got the skeleton, but didn't really comment on anything else. He dismissed the animal bones as deposits from Noah's flood, and used the beads and other artifacts that he did discover around the Red Lady to reinforce his narrative of a female outcast from the Romano-British period. When William Solas came to the site about 80 years later, he discovered a treasure trove of Paleolithic tools. Ah, that word again. Paleolithic. What does it mean? As a rule, I think it's good practice to discuss old things in as plainer English as possible. Keeps things easier to understand. However, technical terms have a nasty habit of cropping up, and often they're there because they're useful. Paleolithic is one of those. In fact, the names separating history into different periods are some of the more useful technical terms in archaeology. They allow us to separate a huge chunk of time into more manageable, cohesive bits that allow for a more focused study. The Stone Age in particular requires a lot of separating. The Stone Age runs from the first bashed up rocks by the earliest hominins like Homo habilis, all the way through to the dazzling flint hand axes used by the people who built Stonehenge. The overwhelming majority of human history is the Stone Age. All but 4,000 years of human existence were spent using stone tools. So initially, the Stone Age gets divided into three parts. There's the New Stone Age, the Middle Stone Age, and the Old Stone Age. Because academics like to make it clear how smart they are, they change those words into Greek. Stone in Greek is lithic, and if you stick with this podcast, we're going to use the word lithic in some form or another very, very much. But back to the Greek. New in Greek is neo, middle, meso, and old, paleo. When we come to them, we'll explain more about the New Stone Age, or Neolithic, and the Middle Stone Age, Mesolithic. However, today we're discussing the Paleolithic, the Old Stone Age, a period that covers 99% of human histories. So of course archaeologists made things more complicated by also dividing the Paleolithic into three parts. The good news is there's no more Greek to learn. First of all, there's the Lower Paleolithic, and that's the really old stuff. There are no Homo sapiens or modern humans in the Lower Paleolithic. Logically, after the Lower Paleolithic comes the Middle Paleolithic. That's the period where you get Homo neanderthalensis and Homo heidelbergensis, the topics of last podcast. Finally, you get the Upper Paleolithic. This, in a word, means cavemen. Not literally, of course, but it's what the media imagines when it talks about the Upper Paleolithic. Hopefully, the rest of this podcast will be trying to give you some idea of what it was like to live in the Upper Paleolithic. The way we've split prehistory up is based predominantly on technological changes. The change from the Middle Paleolithic to the Upper Paleolithic is associated with more refined flint tools. The reason the Red Lady of Paviland is such a brilliant site is that not only do we get a very rare skeleton, but we also get a skeleton buried deliberately and associated with a wide range of artifacts. In and around the Red Lady were thousands of flint tools, teeth, bone needles, and bracelets. If you want to be very specific, most of these tools date to the Aurignacian and Gravettian cultures, but all that's for another and much nerdier podcast than the one you're already listening to. What's so special about these tools? Well, they're extremely old. So old, in fact, that they're the first definite examples of a culture in Europe. What do I mean by culture? I'm not going to go too deep into that question, but here's the funny thing about humans. We're not very good at doing the most sensible of things. Let's take flint tools, for example. The very earliest examples are just humans knocking a bit of rock off another bit and then using the sharp edge for skinning a zebra or whatever early hominin activity you fancy doing. However, it didn't take long for humans to start doing more than just knocking on a rock and using what fell off. We began to shape the tools. We made them symmetrical. Started shaping them to fit our hands. We dulled the edges a little bit so that they'd last longer. And sometimes, when our friends died, we left particularly lovely tools with them. Humans immediately attached themselves to their creations and imbibed them with meaning. Not only that, but we generally began to agree on what was beautiful and what a well-made tool was. Some people began using the tools to create items that had no usefulness whatsoever, and we'll come on to that. What's going on then are different people are agreeing on what a good tool is, and so they're all trying to make that tool that fits the ideal they've already agreed upon. When they drop or deliberately leave those tools, we find them later on. We plot them on our map. And over time, evidence begins to appear of people across thousands of square miles sharing in a certain cultural idea. It gets more exciting than that. Modern British and Americans share more than just a love of fast food. We share music, clothing, political opinions, sexual opinions, and religious beliefs. So if you're a future human who discovered a McDonald's whilst digging at a site in London and saw that it was very similar to New York, a site which you knew a lot about, you can make some very well-educated guesses about what London culture was like. You could associate British culture with American culture because we had shared cultural ideas and they're represented in the stuff we leave behind. Maybe you'd miss out on the subtleties, but you'd be broadly right. Flint tools were the Big Macs of the Stone Age. They were everywhere. Different people did make tools in different ways, and the tools we find around the Red Lady are very similar to a culture that spreads from England and Wales, through France and Spain, past the parts of Germany and Switzerland not covered by glaciers, to Italy, Greece, the Balkans, and even the Crimean Peninsula. This is a vast range, but the culture is broadly consistent, and for the most part, so is the climate. I mean, let's not get carried away though. British people weren't in direct communication with Italians or Greeks. When we talk about culture in this period, the most we can imagine is a series of interlinking communities. Each community might only know about the existence of their neighbours, those communities that they shared hunting grounds with. However, that chain of neighbours spread across Europe, and it means we see similar creations all across Europe and down towards the Middle East. And that just isn't flint tools. I think the reason that cavemen are so compelling isn't because they lived in caves or hunted giant animals. I think it's the men part. These aren't some hefty Neanderthals hunting saber-toothed cats by punching them on the nose. These were men and women who, for all intents and purposes, were like modern humans. They would have lived and loved, cared for their children, gossiped and made friends, just like we do. We know that because it is in the Upper Paleolithic that we get consistent and unquestionable evidence of the most intensely human of all experiences, individual expression. The Red Lady of Paviland was alive during the first explosion of creativity. I'll talk about two examples here. Figurines and cave art. Let's take the latter first. European cave art is iconic. The caves of France are littered with the stuff. For example, at Chauvet in southern France, there's layers upon layers of horses, lions, rhinos, bison, and all the other animals that would have been useful for a hunter to know about when planning where he might go. I do think these images are about communicating with each other. When we get to the skeleton itself, I'm going to bring back this idea of the Red Lady being a member of a community that spread in the linked way we discussed right across modern Europe. I don't believe these people were getting together en masse and having political summits. But I do think they were very aware of the existence of other humans. I think they were trying to reach out, trying to help their fellow humans. And brag, of course. One of the biggest problems with modern archaeology, especially in how it's often presented to the public, is that there's a desire to put one theory above the other. That approach forgets that humans are a mass of contradictions. There's no reason why the people who painted the caves weren't genuinely trying to help, but also genuinely having a good old brag. How do we know they're bragging? Well, for my money, it's because the art at Chauvet is so brilliantly executed, densely packed and layered, so that later paintings were put on top of other earlier ones. Now, of course, this excellent painting might be for religious reasons. Maybe the paintings and the layerings was to make the images seem more lifelike, so that in flickering flames, the beasts came to life. I think that's very feasible. But it doesn't preclude there being other reasons for making these paintings. Let me give you a more modern, better documented example. The Renaissance painters of Florence have shown us that it is a deeply human thing to be hyper-competitive in creating art that is meant to create a more immersive religious experience and to help the congregation find some moral guidance in the liturgy. Chauvet and other layered sites, including Paviland, which has layers of flint tools deposited around the skeleton, show this contradictory combination of devotion, spiritualism, and competition. It shows, at least to me, that these caves are a bundle of communications left by groups and individuals to be found and added to by other groups and individuals. Those messages are a mixture of humans communicating with each other at a social, here's an important place, sort of way, but also a deeply spiritual, this place is important to us, sort of way. And finally, in a self-expressive, I am important sort of way. So, we've agreed these caves are a place of religious and social importance. But what sort of religion? Let's go back to Paviland. The Red Lady was buried in a heap of red ochre. Ochre's a sandy clay with a bit of gunk in it that gives it its colour. Now that gunk is usually ferric oxide, essentially iron, and that means its colours range from a muted yellow to deep red, depending on how much iron is present. Ochre was important to Stone Age peoples. It's one of the most abundant and simplest pigments humans have access to, and its colours fit the muted shade and high contrast images that we see in a lot of Upper Paleolithic art. In places like Chauvet in central France, humans would chew ochre and then spit the paste onto their outstretched hands pressed against a cave wall. In cave sites like Chauvet and then later on Lassau, there are dozens of handprints reaching out from the cave walls. Those handprints are deep, deep in the caves of Chauvet. These places were difficult to access and pitch black. The sort of darkness where you can wiggle your fingers 2 inches from your eyes and see nothing. Most modern people will rarely experience such darkness. Humans aren't great at hearing, tasting, or smelling, but we're great at seeing. When that sense is lost, you become disorientated. You become hyper-aware of your body and physical sensations become extra stimulating. The feel of a friend's hand is much more comforting. The walls of the cave much closer and much colder. If there's a light, you're drawn to it, but what it shows is distorted. Modern torches create intense shadows or only display a small cone, giving an increased sense that the cave is huge and dark and that this space belongs to otherworldly things. That's been my experience of complete darkness in caves like Chauvet. The archaeology suggests that the people of the Upper Paleolithic agreed with me. It's in these places, where the cave becomes utterly dark, that we find the greatest examples of Upper Paleolithic art. It's in these places we find the handprints. But we also get weird abstract signs, dots and lines and fractal images. There are plaintive deer with disturbed antlers. The dark, muted colours are stark against the light grey of the limestone walls. In firelight, they would have flickered. The sudden burst of flame might have shocked the eyes of the people around, causing them to see spots. Perhaps they captured the weird shapes they saw when light was suddenly returned. Deep, deep into the caves is also where we get potential evidence of a shamanistic religion. A religion that was about connecting with the natural world. In Chauvet, there is an image of what appears to be a deer's head bursting out of a woman's womb. Beyond that, there's a strong connection with the natural world in other artwork. There's loads and loads of images of large prey animals. In cave paintings, they're depicted. At Paviland, horn and antlers were left surrounding the burial. It's at this period, in places like Switzerland, that we get items like the Lion Man, a carved antler showing a male human with the head of a lion, which has often been interpreted as a shamanistic figure. There's also use of the cave as liminal zones. Now, liminal zones, what are they? If you stick with this podcast, it's important we discuss them. They're one of the ideas I find most fascinating. You see, humans seem to be drawn to in-between places. We like shorelines, where the water meets the land, and yet the shore or the beach is somehow neither yet both at the same time. We also like cliff edges where land, sea and air meet. Humans are naturally drawn to forest edges and clearings. We also create spaces like churchyards, which are places full of flowers and trees, both representing life, yet filled with the bones of our dead. All of these contradictory in-between places are called liminal zones, areas where one world meets another. Liminal zones can be prosaic, everyday, useful. Liminal zones, though, are more often than not imbibed with deep spiritual importance. In our modern world, holidays like Easter, New Year's and Halloween represent in-between times. Easter's the shift from winter to spring, the new year, a day caught between the past and the future. And Halloween, well, that's a podcast in its own right. But that day represents a time of gathering darkness as autumn turns to winter. Going back in the Neolithic, about 25,000 years after the Red Lady, tombs were made to be visited at regular intervals so that the living could communicate with the dead in a space that wasn't quite the world of the dead, but wasn't quite the world of the living either. Caves seem to play a similar role for the people of the Upper Paleolithic. Every major religious find from the Upper Paleolithic, the ceremonial burial of the Red Lady of Paviland, the cave paintings at Chauvet, and the examples of portable art we have from Switzerland, linemen sculptures, flutes, and figurines of women with highly exaggerated bodies, all of these examples are found in caves. However, unlike the cave art of Chauvet, burials like Paviland and the figurines from Switzerland tend to be found closer to the entrances of caves, close to where the light, open world meets the dark, hidden caves. A liminal zone, an in-between place, filled with intrinsic emotional significance. It appears that in these in-between places, humans practiced a rudimentary spiritualism that was all about bridging the gap between the physical world and the mystical world. I think the Red Lady of Paviland was buried deliberately in a relatively shallow cave. And I think the Red Lady was buried for similar reasons that the Lion Man was made and left in the shallow caves of Hollenstein Stadel. I think that the humans of the Upper Paleolithic gave these places cultural and religious significance. Let's think about the world at the time of the burial. The Red Lady of Paviland dates from a period in between two glacial periods. Britain was turning from a polar desert into a tundra capable of supporting human life. Now, that's not to say life was exactly blossoming. Instead, the groups that began to inhabit Britain were probably small communities seeking to explore new opportunities. It may have been that there was a population increase in Europe due to the warmer weather. It might have been that certain animals migrated north and so some groups followed them. In the end, it could have just been curiosity on behalf of these groups. They might have just been interested to see what was happening in the world. Never doubt the human ability to do something just because, you know. These groups may not have had a deep tie to the land. The climate was really very variable during the Paleolithic, with the glaciers expanding and then retreating like a creaking, colossal accordion of ice. People moved into Britain when it was there, and retreated back to France when the glaciers began to reclaim the land. Therefore, these people were, for the most part, transitory. They were looking to explore and exploit resources before pulling back to less chilly climes. Therefore, they probably didn't visit sites very often and probably chose shallow caves because they were safer and known quantity. Deeper caves were unexplored. Unlike in France, there was no social memory of where they were and what they were like. Instead, people like the Red Lady of Paviland were probably in Britain to do a job. What was that job? Well, to hunt and to fish. We've not really spoken about fishing just yet, but it was definitely a part of the Paleolithic diet. Using some very clever technology, we've managed to extract bone protein from the fossils, and the data suggests that the diet of the Red Lady of Paviland was 15 to 20% fish. Now that makes sense. Britain was only ever tenuously connected to the continent. Paviland, even during this age of low sea levels, was close to the sea. 70 kilometres is not far away for a group that is constantly moving. However, the other 80% of the diet was probably primarily large mammal meat. This would have been supplemented by nuts, berries, wild vegetables and grains. Most of their food would have been highly seasonable. But it's not unimaginable that they would have dried some of their meat to take a version of unspiced biltong or pemmican. This is a very common practice amongst nomadic hunter-gatherer groups. So all in all, we know that these humans saw caves as an important site, both as a refuge, but also as religious places. We know these humans were hunting, gathering, and fishing. But there's a little bit more to learn about before we get to the skeleton itself. In Paviland, we've discovered over 5,000 stone fragments, perhaps the largest single collection of Upper Paleolithic lithics found in the UK. These are scattered around the skeleton and date from a variety of different periods. A grave good assemblage usually refers to the objects deliberately deposited with a person when they're buried. While some of the objects, specifically the ones that aren't lithics, like the beads, the rods and the rings, probably were buried with the Red Lady, many of the other items from the period of the burial probably were not left with the Red Lady at the time of the burial. Instead, there were multiple objects, knives, animal remains, and those thousands of flints we discussed, deposited for a long time after the Red Lady was buried. Most archaeologists believe that this is because Paviland was an unusual place, a religious site, and that Goat's Hole had a draw on the hunter-gatherers. Indeed, the site was visited right up until the glaciers returned and almost crushed this site beneath their icy heft. So how was the Red Lady buried? It appears the Red Lady was laid down on their back. On the chest were laid magic wands made of ivory. The Red Lady was probably clothed when they were buried. There were periwinkle shells around the waist, which may reflect some sort of decorated belt, since they had holes in them so they could be strung together. There were also some rings of ivory that appeared to be bracelets, but they weren't found near the wrists. Again, it's tempting to define those as decorations for the clothing the Red Lady wore. What's really exciting is that buried with the Red Lady was the head of a mammoth. Once the body had been placed in the ground with the great guts and the mammoth head, it was scattered, or more likely covered, with the red ochre to create a red mound in the cave. There's lots to get into here, but I think the critical items are the rods or wands and the mammoth skull. The rods have been interpreted as wands, as they were too thin, too dull and unsharpened to have had a real practical use. Furthermore, they were slightly bulbous at one end. When there's no logical explanation for an item in a burial, it's common practice to label it as mysterious and ritualistic. In this case, I don't see a problem with that. This burial, like all burials, is a mysterious and ritualistic act. And that mammoth skull, well, doesn't that remind you of the close association with animals that we've just been discussing? What does all this tell us about the Red Lady? Potentially that they were part of a hunting party looking for mammoths, but potentially they may have been someone who was a shaman or had some deeper than average connection with the animal world. They probably died of disease. The Red Lady was buried with care and left with items of religious significance and buried in that religiously important red soil, the source of the dyes used to create artwork. Of course, this could be sentimentality, but the care the humans who buried the Red Lady took and the paucity of Upper Paleolithic burials suggest that this was a religious ceremony. Maybe it was to bless the area as a source of good hunting. Maybe it was to ward off the bad luck that had been caused by the Red Lady's death. Or maybe we're seeing a practice of marking an area with a burial. This last theory is a theme that's going to play out in many discussions of death. Often in prehistory, burials were used to signify important areas or act as territorial borders. Perhaps the Red Lady was buried to communicate with other human groups that they were in a prime hunting spot, or to ward off other human groups by telling them that this was a place that belonged to the Red Lady of Pavilan's band. Or just perhaps it was a combination of all those theories. The Red Lady may have been deeply pious and highly liked. When they died, they were buried in a spot popular with their band to bless that area and to make it clear to other groups that this was their special place and not that of others. That's how I imagine it. I believe it's good practice to think complexly about the motivations of ancient people. No human action is ever taken in isolation. I also think that when you do think complexly about the results of an ancient action, like a burial, you discover so much more about the past people. They begin to come to life and stop being these objects of interest that we put in museums, but start to become real, living, breathing people. People like you or me. Humans. What does my story of the Red Lady of Pavilan tell us? Well, it tells us that these people had a faith that was deeply connected to the natural world. We learn that there was a small, tightly knit group of friends and family who existed in a world of complicated socio-political relationships with other small, tightly knit groups of friends and family. The relationships between those groups would have been marked by a contradictory blend of support, codependence, and competition. Different groups needed each other. They needed to find mates outside of their immediate gene pool. They needed to share knowledge and potentially resources. However, all humans in Upper Paleolithic Europe existed in a marginal, fragile ecosystem, which meant that competition for resources was fierce. We also discovered that the people took pride in how they looked and where they were from. All in all, by looking deeply and complexly at the Red Lady of Pavilan, we discover a society that had deep and complicated relationships with themselves, with other people, with the land, its resources, and with the nature of reality itself. By looking deeply at the Red Lady of Pavilan and respecting their remains enough to think complexly about them, we discover eternal truths about what it means to be a human. Now, let's finally talk about the skeleton itself. You might find it odd that I've waited this long to really speak about the Red Lady. We've discussed the archaeologist, the site, the grave goods, and yet, apart from a brief summary of the extant skeleton, there's been barely 5 words on the body itself. Now, of course, that's deliberate. So often, major discoveries like the Red Lady of Pavilan block out all the other interesting information surrounding their discovery. If we discuss the British Mesolithic or even the very beginnings of humanity in the future, it's going to become clear just how much can be learned from archaeological sites, even when the actual human remains are minimal, sometimes non-existent. The site of Pavilan is so rich in information and shares so much with a wide range of archaeological sites that to focus purely on the skeleton itself does disservice to the archaeologists who dug there, and also stars as opportunities to learn more about human history. We chose Pavilan for a reason. If we just wanted to talk about nomadic hunter-gatherers, we could have gone to Creswell Crags and done a great job. Instead, we chose an ocean-splashed hole on the south coast of Wales, and that's because it contained a skeleton. Skeleton that had been dyed red. That single body raises so many questions. Why was it buried when so many weren't? Why was it buried in this cave? Why was it buried in a cave at all? Was it dyed red deliberately? And if so, why? What can we learn about Stone Age society from this body? It's all fascinating, but let's start out by laying the field. What and who is the Red Lady of Pavilan? Beneath the red ochre was a skeleton. We discussed that it was probably clothed, However, by the time we found the body, any clothing had long rotted away. Quite a bit of the skeleton has also been lost, perhaps due to a combination of occasional flooding, animal interference, and people taking some pretty gruesome souvenirs. All that is left are the large bones to the left-hand side of the body. No hands exist, nor do most of the ribs. There's no skull. Because of the ochre, every bone is dyed an even dark red. Buckland took the isolated location of the skeleton and its strange coloration to suggest that the human to whom the skeleton belonged was an individual on the edges of society, potentially murdered for the lifestyle. William Buckland described the Red Lady of Pavilion as a female, either a prostitute or a witch from the Roman period. We've obviously established before that Buckland was way out on his dates. But he didn't just get the age wrong. He got the sex of the skeleton wrong too. The Red Lady of Paviland is a man, a young man, probably in his early to mid-20s. We've spoken before in both this episode and last episode how humans were always parts of groups. So how big was the group that the Red Lady of Paviland was part of? Homo sapiens tend to arrange the people they know into concentric circles with themselves at the center. Atomic egotism, if you will. The first level beyond the self are the support groups, the 3 to 5 people who are your very closest pals. And after that circle is the sympathy group, another 10 to 12 people who you care very deeply for. This slightly larger group is vital. It's that group that is traditionally the layer that provides support for child rearing and also advice and stress reduction. They're your friends and your family. These two groups sit within a larger affinity group. That's about 50 people. They're not a tight friendship. They aren't stag do's. However, at this size of group, you can still have a deep personal relationship with every individual, but it also provides you a variety of skills and abilities within the group. And finally, we come to the special number, the number that's thrown around by anyone who's glanced at an anthropology book. 150. The Dunbar number. Now, who is this Dunbar? And how did he get his own number? Mr. Dunbar, in a famous bit of anthropology, purported that all human groups tend to have a maximum limit of 200. He took an evolutionary approach and argued that our increased brain size and language use was to enable humans to maintain larger groups more efficiently, rather than relying purely on typical primate bonding techniques like grooming. Vitally, these groups didn't need to live in the same place. Indeed, it's expected that an individual social system works across different groups. Purportedly, this is the natural size of a human community. Now, whilst the maximum size is 200, the normal size is somewhere between 100 and 150. To drive this point home, 100 to 120 people is the average size of a modern Western wedding. Since this is probably the only time a Western person is able to bring their entire network together, it's interesting to note that we tend towards the lower end of this purported natural size. Furthermore, 62% of people have between 1 and 250 friends on Facebook. So how many people were with the Red Lady of Paviland when he died? Now obviously that's very difficult to say. In a marginal environment like the far north of Ice Age Europe, groups tend to be more fragmentary. Furthermore, hunter-gatherer groups of 150 only happen on specific occasions and usually represent multiple smaller groups joining up, perhaps for ritual activity or due to a short-lived bout of plenty, such as during reindeer migrations. It is likely that if he was hunting when he died, he was probably with a group of around 15 individuals. So then, whilst we've been able to speak quite certainly about many elements of this site, the culture, the religion, the climate, that's because we can cross-reference many different sites and compare that to modern ethnography. We're starting to get into the realms of, I think, and this is my opinion. We glossed over one thing, but let me restate it. The reason we called the Red Lady, is because William Buckland, against his better judgment, just decided that this skeleton was a female. It fitted his theory of the skeleton being some sort of social pariah, like a witch or prostitute. Now, needless to say, this is terrible archaeology. However, one of the best things Buckland did was to get the sex of the skeleton wrong. That's because there's very few skeletons from this period, and usually they're very hard to sex. However, because we've got the pelvis of the skeleton, we're very certain it's male. And the fact most people come to this skeleton thinking it was a woman gives us an opportunity to discuss gender roles in the Upper Paleolithic. This is a very difficult topic, but it's one which is important and interesting. Anthropological evidence suggests that hunter-gatherer communities in general tend towards a sexual division, with men doing the hunting and women the gathering. However, rather than wading into this debate willy-nilly, let's look at the evidence for a sexually egalitarian society and those against a sexually egalitarian society. It's obviously a futile exercise to try and find some definite answers, but let's try and apply the ancient evidence of the past to a very modern issue. First of all, in the pro-egalitarian corner are two key points. The first being the nature of food acquisition during this period. The second being the Venus figurines. As we've mentioned, the Red Lady of Pavlan's diet was a better balanced one than we usually think. When we compare his bone protein analysis with ethnographic evidence of other hunter-gatherer groups, it's probable that his diet was a varied and well-balanced one, with plenty of fish, meat, fruit, and vegetables. Now, the fruit and veggies weren't like the ones we eat today. They'd have been smaller, less nutritious wild ancestors of many of the fruit and vegetables we eat today. But that doesn't mean that humans didn't turn their native ingenuity into improving fruit and vegetable access. We're about 25,000 years away from the invention of farming. However, hunter-gatherers as a habit do garden, as in they'll often clear away undesirable species and promote the growth of other species, usually in areas which they visit regularly. Some people actually think this is how farming got started, but that's for another day. Paleolithic humans were moving, always, affecting their landscape in small, subtle ways. Most modern hunter-gatherer tribes work less than in agricultural societies. In those agricultural societies, until social stratification kicks in, everybody is focused on providing a limited number of foods. In hunter-gatherer societies, diversification is your friend. That means that only small groups go out hunting or fishing, whilst others will stay back, looking after the children, building camp, scouting ahead, or foraging for fruits, nuts, berries, and vegetables. The question is then, did women and men do these tasks equally? Well, for obvious reasons, women probably did the majority of childcare. However, if we use biological reasons to explain the female role in childbearing, what are the biological impediments for women to not be involved in other activities in an equal way? Human females are physically different to men. This, for the nerds, is called sexual dimorphism. In humans, and most great apes, sexual dimorphism is mild. Males tend to be slightly larger, with slightly greater muscle mass, especially in their upper bodies. Women tend to have a higher body fat percentage. Does the slightly weaker female body prevent them from hunting and fishing? No. Humans definitely fished, but that would be coastal fishing using nets, spears, and maybe simple rod and lines. There's no reason why women couldn't do that. Spear and rod fishing requires accuracy and patience, and not that much strength. Net fishing is more difficult, but people rarely fish alone because it's so boring. So there are people there to help if you have a haul of biblical proportions. And obviously, women aren't that significantly weaker than men. Hunting's a little bit more complicated to explain. We don't have a lot of evidence from human hunts. So, warning here. I'm about to conflate evidence from tens, even hundreds of thousands of years of human history. From what I've been able to gather, the evidence of human hunting falls into four categories. The first is the scavenging method. There's a theory that the tool use and larger human brains developed because we focused not on eating the meat from animals we killed, but from scavenging the kills of better hunters. We would then break open skulls and bones to access the fatty, calorie-rich brains and bone marrow. This is a brilliant strategy. Bone marrow and offal is delicious, and getting it, especially after some hyenas have done your dirty work for you, requires very little energy. So you get a lot of calorific bang for your buck. You can use that energy to invest in a larger brain and improve social skills. The second option is exhaustion hunting. Humans are physically impressive. We are one of the very few animals to sweat, and that, combined with our lithe figures and upright posture, means we're really, really good at long-distance running. So good, in fact, that a very reasonable hunting strategy is to scare your prey into scarpering off, and then follow it at a leisurely jog. You keep doing this for a little while, and at the end, the poor beast collapses from exhaustion. you, a human, are tired and sweaty, but in good shape, and the group you're with are more than able to finish the animal off, butcher it, and get at the scrummy marrow and organs, as well as the meat. The third way is what I call the oops, you fell off a cliff method. We're pretty certain this method was used in the European Paleolithic. Here, the plan is to find a group of animals that gather into herds. Mammoth and rhinos and deer are good choices. You follow them until they're close to a cliff or some other natural obstacle, like a peat bog. Then you do the hunter-gatherer equivalent of jumping out from behind a wall and shouting boo. You create a lot of noise, maybe run at the animals, start throwing rocks and pointy sticks. Hopefully the herd, as herds often do, will run away in a mass stampede. If you do things right, the stampede takes them straight over the cliff. And just as they get into grips with the concept of reality and gravity, they crash into the ground, leaving you to harvest their mangled corpses. The final method is the waterhole method. Here, a human or a group of humans goes to a waterhole, somewhere lots of animals gather. Maybe it's actually a clearing or a particularly lush meadow. The humans then get close to the animals and use your spear throwers, sharpened sticks, bows and arrows, and other cruel missiles to attack the animals whilst they're having a nice drink or grassy snack. This is the method we discussed last episode. But for now, the question is, for all of these hunting methods, are they so physically demanding that a woman can't do them? I don't think so. Three of the four methods just require you to be able to keep up with the group, which obviously women can do. The fourth one, the throwing of sticks and stones at unsuspecting animals, does benefit from a stronger throw, but it benefits more from having lots of humans throwing lots of pointy objects. I guess the point of all this is there's no biological reason that women did not get involved in hunting or any other activity. If anybody ever tells you that women should stay at home because they're somehow biologically inferior and that humans evolved so that men should go out to the hunting office, tell them to stop being ludicrous and study archaeology. Also, if men were so much more physically impressive than women, why did they all go off to hunt? Why aren't they at home protecting the women? These groups are so small that even if one or two men left, that's half the camp being left to be protected by the young and the old blokes who've forgotten which point of the spear to stab the animal with. Hunter-gatherer societies which use mixed-sex hunting tend to be more successful at hunting than those who rely purely on men or women. Furthermore, we do have evidence that women were out there on the front lines. We have these Venus figurines, small ivory objects from central European caves showing highly exaggerated women, massive bottoms and huge boobs. Again, there's probably an episode to be made purely on Paleolithic art. But for now, let's just say that some archaeologists have suggested that these figures were made by women to represent themselves. If, as the Red Lady of Paviland and Chauvet suggest, that caves were launching off points for hunts, the presence of women at those sites closely associates them with the hunt. Now, all of that said, those arguments assume that humans are rational and make the best decisions for themselves. However, as I sip my recording beer, which contains literal poison, I realise that humans never make the decisions that are logical or in their best interests. We are creatures built from layers and layers of social expectation. Why should our ancestors be any different? If we look at those Venus figurines again, there are a couple of other theories that suggest women didn't have a hand in making them. The first is that they're semi-religious. Slightly pornographic mementos created by the men and left in their camps. There might be a belief that the giver of life, the female body, was required to be symbolically present during the festival of death, which is most hunts. And, of course, it might just be that lonely men like big boobs and bums. Another theory is that these figurines aren't religious and that they're actual literal representations of the women who are depicted in the figurines. Many women in hunter-gatherer societies have a condition where their bums store in an extreme amount of fat as a protection against famine. Even though hunter-gatherer societies have more downtime than agricultural ones, even though they had a wider variety of food, and even though they lived longer than the people who lived via subsistence farming, they are more susceptible to climatic change and thus famine. Indeed, because the hunter-gatherer lifestyle is hyper-seasonal, you need strategies to protect against unexpected famine. It doesn't take long for humans to starve to death, so even a short bout of famine can be deadly. In hunter-gatherer societies which do have a sexual division of labour, Sometimes women evolved to have a famine insurance strategy that they carry on their bum. Even if there was a sexual division of labour, that doesn't correlate to a sexual division of power. Many matriarchal societies have a sexual division of labour. And I know plenty of women that like the idea of being in charge and sending men out to do the difficult and boring tasks. With the vast profusion of human societies that have existed, there has definitely been societies where the women are in charge and the men do all the work. There is no evidence against European Paleolithic societies being like that. Essentially, we'll never know. You make up your mind on what is more likely. But don't argue too strongly that humans are naturally egalitarian or naturally divided. Humans are naturally very little. We live too much in the lives of other humans. The Red Lady is precious. There probably aren't very many like him in Britain. This island was at the forefront of repeated glacial expansions, which obliterated much of our early prehistory. In the Red Lady of Pavilan's half body, dyed red and left in a cave, there's connections for us to make. Connections that, when you start reading, open up a vast trove of information about our ancient world. This man, the Red Lady of Pavilan, had friends. In fact, he must have been so respected or loved that he was made into an embodiment of shamanic belief, a representative connection to his wider social network between the human world and the terrifying, constantly changing, capricious natural world in which he lived. What is amazing isn't just that the Red Lady of Pavilan exists, but that he's only one of many humans that we've discovered. Each one is a macabre, tactile connection with our ancestors. Studying and discussing sites like Pavilan help us learn more about ourselves. It makes us appreciate the world we have and places us in a long line of humans who have been fighting against a violent and nasty world to create some meaning. This podcast is going to talk about more people like the Red Lady. We'll come to realize that a skeleton is not just a skeleton, but a jumping off point into the ancient world. Next time, things get darker. We discuss the bodies at Gough Cave, the classic image of hunter-gatherers, and whether or not early British people engaged in cannibalism. If you've enjoyed this podcast and want to discover more or simply wish to help me out, please tell your friends and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. We also have a Patreon, Facebook, and Instagram. All the links are in the show notes. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is All Bones. See you soon.